content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today we're going to read from Volume 63, Number 1, the Fall 2023 issue, It's Revolutionary, Prelude to War. And the first article will be The Regulation, Conflict in Backcountry North Carolina by Lisa Cox, who is a historical interpreter at Alamance Battleground State History Site. She enjoys keeping the past alive through her living history programs and costumed interpretation. Several years before the American Revolution, many citizens in the Piedmont region of North Carolina became upset with the way the local government was conducting the colony's affairs. They were not upset with the form of government or the rule of law, but with abuses by local officials. There were excessive taxes, illegal fees, and dishonest sheriffs. For example, a farmer could be charged more than the law allowed, and the official would keep the extra money for himself. There was not a lot of money available in the colony, and that also contributed to unrest. The Piedmont farmers felt they had nothing in common with the wealthy landowning Easterners, so it was in the backcountry that the regulation began. Formation of the Regulators. In the spring of 1768, a group of North Carolinians formed an association, and they gave themselves the name Regulators. They were going to, quote, regulate public grievances and abuse of power, unquote. Several men became prominent in the movement, including James Hunter, William Butler, Redknapp Howell, and Herman Husband. Howell, a local schoolmaster, wrote songs that spread the news of the corruption of local attorney and Orange County Register of Deeds, Edmund Fanning. When Fanning first to Orange came, he looked both pale and wan, an old patched coat upon his back, an old mare he rode on. Both man and mare want worth 5 pounds, as I've been often told, but by his civil robberies he laced his coat with gold. The farmers resort to violence. The regulators tried peaceful negotiations and petitions, but became very discouraged. As a form of protest, many refused to pay their taxes. In the spring of 1768, the Orange County Sheriff took a regulator's horse for tax payment. As a result, a group of 70 angry regulators stormed into Hillsboro, tied up the sheriff, and shot holes in Fanning's house. By 1770, the regulators took over superior court sessions in Hillsboro. They physically beat judges, lawyers, and other officials with clubs, and proceeded to disrupt and take over the court. Royal Governor William Tryon acted to bring this backcountry rebellion to a speedy conclusion. He decided to call out North Carolina militia volunteers to march against the regulators. The militia were citizens of North Carolina, not professional soldiers. Governor Tryon marched to Hillsboro with 1,100 men. By May 15th, they had camped on the banks of Alamance Creek. Just a few miles away, 2,000 regulators had assembled. The Battle of Alamance, 1771. On Thursday, May 16th, the militia marched to where the regulators were waiting. Did some of the militia know the regulators? Yes. John Butler mustered in as a lieutenant in the Orange County detachment. His brother William Butler took a stand with the regulators. The farmers were given an hour to disperse but did not. Lacking organization, arms, and ammunition, they were no match for Tryon's militia in battle. The regulators were crushed. Exact numbers of killed and wounded are unknown. Governor Tryon reported 9 militia killed and 61 wounded. Prisoners were taken, and on June 19th in Hillsboro, 6 regulators were hanged. Is there a significance in the regulators' struggle? The regulation illustrates discontent in the colony before the War of Independence. According to historian William Powell, It was outside the province of North Carolina that the Regulator movement had one of its greatest effects. In Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, where the people were on the verge of revolution, the press gave lurid pictures of the struggle of oppressed North Carolinians. Sympathy was aroused and feelings were stirred up, all of which added to the growing movement which soon led to the American Revolution. In North Carolina, many Regulators and former members of the militia joined to fight for the Patriot cause. Others decided to remain loyal to their country, England, and fight as loyalists. Here are the captions for the photographs accompanying this article. North Carolina reenactors in period costumes portray militia under the command of Royal Governor William Tryon. This map was created in 1771 by Claude Joseph Sauthier, born 1726, died 1802. It portrays topographically the location of the Battle of Alamance fought on May 16, 1771, between the Regulators and the militia of North Carolina commanded by Governor William Tryon. This monument stands at Alamance Battleground State Historic Site in present-day Alamance County. The monument was dedicated on May 29, 1880 to commemorate the battle fought between the Regulators and Governor William Tryon's militia on May 16, 1771. The next article is Tryon Palace, Let's Travel Back in Time, by Madeline Flagler, who has deep roots in North Carolina. She was born in Raleigh and grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, but spent every holiday and vacation with family in Wake and Nash counties and at Wrightsville Beach. Currently at Tryon Palace as Education Branch Head, Flagler has worked in the museum field for more than 20 years. Her previous work was at Mission Houses Museum in Honolulu, Hawaii, and Bellamy Mansion Museum and Wrightsville Beach Museum in Wilmington, North Carolina. Her areas of interest are in African American history and broadly in expanding and deepening stories told at sites to be inclusive on more levels. Working at a historic site is unlike any other job. You are able to come in each day and do the jobs the way they were done before electricity, cars or trucks, microwave ovens, computers or smartphones. We are historians and reenactors, people who show visitors how things used to look and how things were done long ago. For example, at Tryon Palace State Historic Site, when our Revolutionary War soldier reenactor comes into work, he looks like he is from the 1770s from head to toe. He begins his day here by going to the encampment area to start a fire. The encampment is the place where troops have set up camp. He arrives in his blue, knee-length soldier outfit. He brings with him some sausage, collards, flour, and butter to make a typical soldier's meal. He starts the fire without matches because they were not invented and in common use in North Carolina in the 1770s. Instead, he uses a small piece of steel and scrapes it across a flint stone, making a spark to catch a fire on a prepared piece of cloth. Then he blows on the embers and adds dried grass, leaves, and sticks, letting the fire build until it will begin to work on a log in the fire. To get the fire hot enough to cook the food, he needs to start this outside fire an hour or two before he wants to cook anything. At that point, the soldier or someone else in the camp will use a heavy iron pan to start the sausage and collards, while another reenactor will begin cutting the butter and flour together to make biscuits. The raw biscuits will go into a different pan, one with a top, so that the coals or the hottest part of the wood can go all around the bottom and the top of the pan, so it's more like an oven. Though many things took more time to do and were more difficult 250 years ago, you'll find that they are often more interesting, surprising, and fun. When I was growing up, my favorite books were about the childhoods of people who lived long ago. I loved thinking about how many things were different for people 100 or 200 years ago, from the time they got up in the morning until they went to bed at night. I like to think about what they did not have that we have, and what they had that we do not have. No light that comes from light switches, but candles. No heat from electricity or gas that you never see, but from a fire in a fireplace in every room. No instant hot water from a sink or shower in several places in the house, but water you pump outside from a well or inside in the kitchen that then had to be heated over the fire in the fireplace. Now I work in a place that makes those long ago times come to life in old buildings that we furnish as they would have been long ago. At Tryon Place, we wear clothes that look and function like those worn by people 200 years ago. Sometimes it feels like we are all time travelers. We do a lot of reading about people and what was happening so many years ago. We read what are called primary sources, which are letters and documents written during the time we are studying. These would be newspapers, letters, diaries, and lists of what the businesses bought and sold. We read their letters to find out what they were thinking, what they were concerned about, what was going on in their everyday life, and what news they discussed, both local and national news. We are lucky to have two volumes of letters written by Royal Governor William Tryon, born 1729, died 1788, for whom our palace is named. We also look for clues for those who may not have left anything written down. These would be the local shopkeepers, sailors, and both freed and enslaved African Americans who built the houses, wove cloth, sewed clothes, and were blacksmiths. They were all here and made it so this city could grow and thrive. And though their stories are harder to find, we are learning a lot. Did you know that 5,000 free and enslaved African Americans fought with George Washington and his generals? A group of these men called the Harlow Patriots were from our area. A historian or reenactor at a historic site is a type of detective. We're always looking for clues to make things here more real. For instance, if we decide we want to have a large dance or ball at the palace, we will go through Governor Tryon's letters and see what he wrote about a large dance or ball that he gave. We will look for his notes on who attended and how people behaved. Were they jolly or quiet? And what did they talk about? The new Stamp Act? What dances did they dance? We use the information we find and design how we will hold a ball like Governor Tryon's. The costumer finds the right kinds of materials to use to make the men's suits and ladies' dresses. She looks through books on the history of clothing to find the right style for the time period. Next, she cuts and sews to make the costumes. Then she finds the correct type of jewelry, shoes, and hairstyles. We research the right kinds of music to play and the dances so the guests can learn the steps. Oh, and the food. What foods were served at the time and what did they look like? Next, we create a script of what people were talking about. We select the actors to play the parts, and they learn their lines and the dances. A couple of people research the foods and make some of the foods in the palace kitchen over the fire in the large open hearth. Sometimes if the food would not look pretty for long, it is made out of flour and water and painted with a paintbrush. On the table in the palace dining room, it looks so beautifully elegant. Over the next year, we at Tryon Palace in New Bern will be reenacting things that happened in our city in the 1770s as the governor, the council, and the townspeople prepared for war. In the 1770s, New Bern was the capital of North Carolina. In defiance of the king and governor, the colonists began to talk of the colonies having provincial congresses to discuss our differences with England. Here in New Bern, we held the very first provincial congress held in the 13 colonies. Here are the captions to the photographs that accompany the article. When you visit Tryon Palace today, you will find a military encampment on site. The soldiers there are often cooking over a campfire or making tools. A reenactor dressed as a soldier from the 1st North Carolina Regiment of the Continental Line is grinding coffee beans. The kitchen office was a separate building to the left of Tryon Palace. That's where all the meals for Governor Tryon's family and guests were prepared. A cook and other servants worked there and may have even slept there, too. Meals from the kitchen office were carried by hand to the palace. These costume interpreters helped bring that history to life. This diagram shows the elevation of Tryon Palace, designed by John Hawkes in 1767. An elevation is a view from any side of an object or building. This is the view you would see if you were standing on the ground looking at it. Remedies for sickness and injuries were often prepared by an experienced apothecary. Apothecaries were like modern-day pharmacists. Remedies and tinctures were made from plants, minerals, and other natural material. This drawing of Tryon Palace is from a $5 colonial banknote circa 1775 that is in the Tryon Palace collection. It was engraved by William Tisdale, who was a New Bern resident and silversmith. Did you know it's the only known image of Tryon Palace rendered during its lifetime up to the fire of 1798 that destroyed the building? Read more and see the banknote in the North Carolina Museum of History's collection. When Tryon Palace was completed in 1770, it was one of the finest government buildings in the American colonies and very costly. Can you imagine what colonists must have thought about this building when most of them lived in one-room homes? Here is an accompanying article, Why a Palace? Tryon Palace in New Bern served as the first permanent capital of North Carolina and was home to Royal Governor William Tryon and his family until 1771. Completed in 1770, the Georgian-style structure was designed by London-based architect John Hawkes. Hawkes traveled to the colonies with Governor Tryon to oversee construction of the future seat of government. Some 5,000 pounds were allocated for construction. Another 10,000 pounds was appropriated to ensure the completion of the project due to the lavish and extravagant upgrades requested by Governor Tryon. To put those numbers into perspective, that's roughly $2.6 million today, all of which colonists were expected to pay through increased taxes. Colonists were resentful of the over-the-top house, and Tryon's palace became a physical representation of colonial frustrations. In 1768, Orange County Justice of the Peace Tyree Harris recalled hearing a regulator say, "We are determined not to pay the tax for the next 3 years for the edifice or the governor's house. We want no such house, nor will we pay for it." In 1798, fire destroyed the palace. The kitchen office was later destroyed. In the 1950s, the palace was reconstructed on the original foundation using the original plans. The stable office is the only remaining building from the 1700s on the site. Pictured above is King George III's seal. The seal over the main entry door, up high toward the roof, would have shown to everyone visiting that this is a building governed under the rule of the King of England. The next article is Decisions and Defiance, Woman Making History by Lucas D. Crumling, who is from York, Pennsylvania, and has been captivated by history for as long as he can remember. A graduate of Sheppard University in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, he is currently a historic interpreter at Historic Edenton. He enjoys sharing the dynamic and vibrant history of Edenton with visitors from all over. It was autumn in the province of North Carolina. In Edenton, on the shores of the Albemarle Sound, ships from distant lands unloaded their cargoes on the bustling docks. In the town itself, and in the surrounding countryside, many women were discussing the ever more pressing political situation. Eventually, 51 of those white women came to a common decision and signed a document they devised supporting resolves, which are statements declaring a firm decision or a planned course of action. Resolves recently passed by the Provincial Congress of North Carolina, the group of leaders who met to organize the colony's patriots. Among the issues that troubled these women were the taxes on imported goods such as tea. For them, these taxes were the final straw in a series of unpopular acts passed by Parliament, which was an entire ocean away. Their resolution, dated October 25, 1774, demonstrated their bold defiance of the king. Sentiments in the American colonies toward Great Britain had steadily soured in the years leading up to this October day. Yet just a decade before, many colonial Americans had celebrated the coronation, the act or occasion of crowning a new king or queen, of King George III in 1761. Newspapers published accounts of the coronation with enthusiasm. The Boston Evening Post dedicated the whole first page of four successive issues to detailed retellings of the coronation ceremony. The king's likeness even appeared on commemorative medals, tavern signs, newspapers, and buttons. Portraits of the new monarch were printed exclusively to fit in pocket watch cases for individuals to treasure, just as one puts a photograph of their loved one in a locket. However, a series of acts passed by Parliament and supported by the king began to damage the royal reputation within the colonies. The first act was to meet in opposition in the colonies. The first act to meet opposition in the colonies was the Sugar Act in 1764, followed by the Stamp Act of 1765. These acts taxed sugar and paper goods, and the money from these taxes went to the British government. This hurt the profits of many businesses and merchants. These unpopular acts were repealed, but were soon replaced by the Townshend Acts in 1767. These acts taxed goods from other countries, including tea. This was met with even more opposition than the previous acts. In addition, the Tea Act of 1773 allowed the British East India Company to sell their tea at a lower price than competitors. That created a monopoly and made it more expensive for colonists to purchase their tea elsewhere. Colonists had no representation in Parliament and were becoming more and more irritated by the decisions made without their input. Protests happened throughout the colonies, but perhaps the most famous was in 1773 with the Boston Tea Party, where colonists disguised as American Indians dumped imported tea into the Boston Harbor. In the late 1800s, the radical action taken by the women of the Edenton area was recast as an actual tea party, so it is usually referred to as the Edenton Tea Party. But it is more probable that their political organization and demonstration did not happen at a single gathering, with or without tea. It was under these circumstances that these 51 women found ways to discuss their role in the current political upheaval. This was unheard of at the time. Women in the American colonies were discouraged or outright forbidden to participate in politics. Social rules of the 1700s limited a woman's role in society. In most circumstances, women of their social class ran their homes, assisted in child-rearing, and managed enslaved workers or servants. They also contributed to and participated in society. Still, the political turmoil of the early 1770s, coupled with their roles in purchasing tea and cloth and other goods, created an opportunity for women to publicize their political opinions. When the first North Carolina Provincial Congress met in August 1774, it passed resolutions declaring that the colonists could not be taxed without their consent. And these women from around Edenton looked for a way to voice their support. Tradition holds that Penelope Barker drafted their own resolution to boycott taxed British goods, and the women signed their names. The resolution states that the women will do everything as far as lies in our power to testify our sincere adherence to not importing British goods, and we do not therefore accordingly subscribe this paper as a witness of our fixed intention and solemn determination to do so. The resolution was printed in the November 3, 1774 edition of the Williamsburg paper, the Virginia Gazette, and was sent to London as well. On January 16, 1775, the Morning Chronicle and London Advertiser reported on the actions of the women. It included a rude caricature, an exaggerated cartoon, showing the women in a quite unflattering way. Many of the women who signed the Edenton Resolves came from similar backgrounds. They were mostly from wealthy, established families who were enslavers and who held political and financial power. Many of their husbands were merchants and business owners, men whose income was impacted by the new taxes. However, even among women with similar backgrounds, the decision to sign such a rebellious resolution varied from person to person. One of these women was Mary Blunt. Her family owned lots of land and was involved in shipping. It was likely, given her background, her decision to sign the resolution while daring would have been a no-brainer. Her family was directly impacted by the acts passed by Parliament. On the other hand, Hannah Iredell, also born into prominence, did not sign the resolution. We do not have a direct account of why she abstained. But we do know that her husband, James Iredell, was the crown's tax collector for the Port of Edenton in 1774. The Iredells eventually supported the revolution, but at that time, Hannah's signature may have hurt her family severely. What would you have done if you lived in Edenton in 1774? Do you think these 51 women made the right choice? The decision of whether to sign the Edenton Tea Party resolution would certainly be difficult. Today, we still remember the actions of these women as the first organized women's political protest in the American colonies. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs. The Penelope Barker House in Edenton is now a welcome center and home to the Edenton Historical Commission. Penelope Barker organized the Edenton Tea Party, the first recorded political protest by women in America. A Society of Patriotic Ladies, 1775. This drawing is a caricature, an exaggerated cartoon that appeared in the Morning Chronicle and London Advertiser. It portrays the women of Edenton pledging to boycott English tea in a very unflattering way. What did these objects have to do with the 1774 Edenton Tea Party? These are tea caddies, special containers used to store loose tea leaves. Actually, historians don't believe that the women of Edenton gathered all at the same time to sign their resolves, let alone to drink tea. But these caddies descended in the families of Mary and Lydia Bonner and Penelope Barker, who added their names to the document, pledging not to use British goods like tea. Next, stories from our collection. Women's Shoes and Shoe Buckle, mid-1700s. How do you fasten your shoes? With shoelaces? With Velcro? In the 1700s, metal buckles helped hold most shoes closed. You can see the crossing fabric tongues that buckles would have held tight on this pair of circa 1760 women's shoes. Many buckles, like our example, feature decorative elements. A fork, circa 1760, a mug, early 1700s, and a butter print, circa 1770. During the 1700s, many North Carolinians were recent immigrants. These pieces survived because people treasured them as objects their ancestor brought with them when they first moved here. Members of the Whitener family brought this fork from Germany around 1760. The mug arrived with an English family in the early 1700s. And the wooden mold, which was used to shape and decorate discs of homemade butter, came with a Scottish family in the 1770s. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.
Turn the gray skies to blue if